Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back. We will have updates throughout the night from both Old Trafford and indeed from Molineux, where Wolves are taking on Arsenal tonight. There is no score there as of yet. And if and when there is, we'll bring you the goals. And a busy night generally on the show. We're going to have Colin O'Brien and James Collins on with us. Reece McLenahan, Wednesday night rugby with Keith Wood and Andy Dunn, all still to come. But last night at Tala Stadium in front of 6,414 fans, Bohemians continued their fine record against their bitter Dublin rival Shamrock Rovers with a 1-0 victory against the ultimately nine men of Rovers following two first half sendings off. The Bohs manager Keith Long joins us on the line. Good evening, Keith.
Hey, Richie.
Great to speak to you. How's been the mood around the club over the course of the past 24 hours? Pretty happy, I'd imagine.
Yeah, certainly. From a supporters' perspective, to get the bragging rights in another Dublin derby was fantastic. Obviously we won previously in Tala last season. We've won earlier in the season here at home in Daly Mount, and to go to Tala in the run of form in which Rovers were in, to come away with the win was fantastic. So, yeah, it's fantastic for the supporters, for the players, everyone around at the club. It's positive. Positive times at Daly Mount.
To call this a victory for bragging rights is to kind of undersell it a little bit. I mean, what this win last night has done potentially to the title race, and we'll get to Bohemians' potential involvement in that in a moment, what it's done is actually, split it wide open yet again. What would have been a 10-point lead for Rovers last night is suddenly five, with yourselves having a game in hand, Dundalk and the likes of Derry in the mix there too still. This is one of the most competitive top flights we've seen in more than half a decade at this stage now.
Yeah, and I suppose the context of the derby changed somewhat last night with us being in third position and Rovers at the top of the table. So it's been a long time since both clubs have been in that position, it was our intention to go there to try and bridge the gap, to try and win the game. Like I said, we had a positive mindset. Our attitude towards playing in Tala is good. We had a firm belief in our game plan and the structure of the team. And it's thrown things open now a little bit. Obviously, Rovers have to go to Dundalk on Friday. I think from our perspective, though, we've got to try and follow up last night with a win against Waterford on Friday ourselves. So it's it's a quick turnaround. We've got 24 hours less preparation than Waterford to prepare for the game. But we've got to capitalise on last night's performance, and I suppose our position in the table. If we're to try and sustain our position what happens up in Oriel Park is irrelevant. We've got to try and look after ourselves and ensure that we follow up last night's performance with a win at home to Waterford on Friday night. So, it's pleasing. It's pleasing the position that we're in at the table at this moment in time, but certainly we're not getting carried away.
Keith, your season so far in charge of Bohemians have been mainly known for pretty strong finishes to the season. What we're seeing now is a really, really good start from your Bohemian side. We're also seeing the youth of the squad as well kind of stepping up. We saw Danny Mandrew play really well last night. We've seen Conor Levingston come into the side and do really, really well. James Talbot's still a young man, brought in goals to replace Shane Supple over the course of the last 6 months too. I mean, this is a young side. There's a good mood around the club. I mean, we've seen the number of sellouts that have been at Daly Mount Park hasn't just been confined to the opening night. This has continued on. I mean, when UCD is selling out at home, you know you're onto a good thing with the club at the moment.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. The crowds have been right behind the team, and to see, obviously we have limitations on the capacity at Daly Mount Park currently, but to see the sellout signs, for games like UCD at home, Derry at home, all our home games so far have been more or less sellouts. So that's fantastic. It's a reward for the hard work that goes on behind the scenes in the community, the volunteers at the club and all their efforts. So it's really pleasing. In terms of the squad, we've got a nice blend of youth and experience, lots of good players that have pedigree coming back from the UK. We've got plenty of experience with our captain, Derek Pender, you know, who leads the team and the boys follow him. And, you know, we've got some very underrated players in this league, and the likes of Keith Buckley and so on. So they've all really helped the younger boys settle in. You've mentioned some names there, James Talbot, Conor Levinson, Danny Mandrew have come in and have done particularly well. You've got young James Finnerty at centre-back that belies his years in terms of his temperament and his performances so far this year. So, yeah, we've got a good complement, a good blend. There's a great atmosphere around the club at the moment. You know, so we've got to try, like I said, capitalise on that and if we can sustain and maintain our position in the league.
Yeah, I mean, Keith, you mentioned those players that come back from over the winter. And I mean, in some cases, they pretty much haven't played men's football at senior level before. I mean, are they surprising you? Or like, I mean, I guess in some of the cases, these derby matches are possibly the biggest games and biggest crowds that they've played in front of, but they seem to be responding to it. I mean, did you see the potential in them all, or are they even surprising you in terms of how they're adapting to it?
Well, they all have pedigree. They've all had outstanding schoolboy careers. They've all played for their country. They've all gone away as young footballers. And for whatever reason, it hasn't quite worked out. You're taking a little bit of a chance, but based on their track record previously, you know, the pedigree, like I say, you'd like to think that they have attributes that you can work with. And, you know, certainly at the moment, it does take a while to gel. But we've hit the ground running from day one. The players have come back in pre-season. We've gelled quickly. We've got some positive results, you know, on the board early in the season. So we've been able to maintain that so far. And last night was a great reward for the players and I suppose their application. Am I surprised? You know, to a certain extent, you know. But you know, like I said, the boys have done exceptionally well. They worked exceptionally hard, and I think if you do that, you know, you get your rewards.
Keith, you're not doing it alone. Trevor Crawley has obviously helped a great deal with the coaching setup over the course of the past 18 months, 2 years or so. Give us a sense of what Trevor's added to your setup there.
Well, this is Trevor's third year with us, and you know, I've gone on record as stating, you know, it's immeasurable, really, the input of Trevor has had on the team and the squad. He's been an integral part of everything that we've done. You know, he's an outstanding coach. You know, and rightly regarded as one of the top coaches in this country. He's got a great football brain, but more importantly, you know, he's a good person. He's a he's a good man, and you know, he brings you know, high standards to the coaching team. But you know, we've got good people at the football club. We've got you know, Chris Bennion, our goalkeeping coach. We've got you know, plenty of people in the backroom staff that are, you know, working towards you know, our goal, which is to try and achieve something this year. You know, everybody is working extremely hard, you know, behind the scenes, the backroom team. You know, they're fantastic, they really are. And like I said, Trevor, you know, has been you know, probably my best signing, if you want to look at it that way, in the 5 years I'm in the job.
What type of, I mean, last night was a strange game in many ways with Rovers down to nine. I mean, what kind of discussions are you having on the sideline when Rovers have their second man sent off? Because you mentioned that you went there with a game plan. I mean, their game plan's out the window, but I guess yours is to some degree as well. I mean, how did you cope with the second half? Because, I mean, it was a sort of a strange game at times because you were comfortable, yet at the same time you were still one mistake from disaster too.
Yeah, I think, you know, we don't plan for the opposition to go down to nine men. You know, it very rarely happens. You know, so it is a little bit unusual for the players, certainly in the second half when Rovers tried to contain and, you know, hit us on the counter or a set play. We probably tried to force the game a little bit. We probably should have been a little bit more patient. I think if we get a second goal early in the second half, maybe we can open them up a little bit more. You know, we probably tried to force the game a little bit. It was unusual for us to be in that scenario. You know, obviously, like you say, you can't plan for that. But, you know, we left ourselves a little bit nervy, you know, to conceding towards the end. But, you know, listen, I think we're full value for the win. You know, our first half performance before the first sending off was really exceptional. You know, we tested Rovers, we stretched Rovers at every opportunity, and I think, listen, we were good value for the win. Obviously, we were helped by some of the decisions. The opposition going down to nine men, they'll feel aggrieved certainly with the penalty scenario. But you know, we have to take that. We didn't get some luck last week in the game against Dundalk. A penalty went the other way, went against us. So and we felt aggrieved. So I suppose in a nutshell, that's football. You just have to get on with it.
Keith, the good news aspect of last night's game won't be lost on you either. Somebody who's been around the league both as a player and a manager for a number of years. I mean, the optics of 6,500 people crammed into Tallaght Stadium of a Tuesday night to watch a Dublin derby, that was possibly the best possible visual the league could have in what's been a pretty rocky time for Irish football over the course of the last 6 weeks.
Yes, to be fair, you know, Tallaght is a proper football stadium, particularly now with the South Stand in place, and to see the crowd and the large vocal travelling support that Bohemians brought with us, you know, was fantastic, and it adds to the atmosphere, it adds to the occasion. It felt like a proper football game last night, two tribes going to war, and you know, we're lucky enough to come out on the right side of it and last night. But yeah, our league needs nights like more nights like last night. It needs, the infrastructure, the facilities need to improve across the board. It's not going to happen overnight, hopefully we can get our own project, Daily Mount Park, get that moving, and we'd love to have something like Rovers have in Tallaght, that we can start building for the future again, and we can have a proper football club in the sense of a brand new stadium with, you know, if we can try to attract more fans to the games, more families to the games. Last night was a great advertisement for League of Ireland football in a proper football stadium on a good night for football on a good football pitch. Listen, 6,500 people, it's very rare that you see that in League of Ireland games, but that's the benchmark. We need to try and achieve that as much as we possibly can.
Keith, it's a topic we can probably get into with more deeply at a later date, but central to the talk of the reformation of the FAI board has been the note that there needs to be more involvement and more hands-on involvement from the league and how the FAI is run, and possibly vice versa as well. That's obviously something you'd like to see going forward, especially given that EGM in the summer.
Yeah, well, I think we've opportunity now for reform. You know, I think the current electoral system doesn't allow for real reform at the moment. I think there's a board of 10 can only be made up from council members, which I think consists of 60 people. So, that means that people with real expertise do not have a chance of becoming, a board member. I think it's a chance for us to maybe get younger, more dynamic individuals with greater expertise, onto the board if we want real reform. So I think we've got to be positive. This is an opportunity. You know, we can't dwell on the past too much. It's an opportunity for us to try and grasp now. And it really needs a top-down, bottom-up approach and a new vision for the professional game in this country is required.
Yeah, Keith, will probably echo those sentiments as well. Thanks so much for taking time out to join us as well. Congratulations on last night's win and best of luck with the rest of the season.
Thank you.
Keith Long there, the Bohemians manager. They are underway in the Manchester derby, just on 2 minutes play. Manchester United 0, Manchester City 0. The big news of the night so far being that Pep Guardiola's half coat, half cardigan remains. We're still this deep into April and he's still going with the coat again, as ratty as it might be at this point of the season. If body language is to be judged, City looking far more relaxed when they're coming out of the tunnel. United looked on the tense side.
And body warmth as well. Body language and body warmth.
Well, Pep thinks of everything. He is a genius in that respect. We'll keep you updated on that throughout the night. At Molineux, it remains Wolves 0, Arsenal 0. And just a note as well, in the Electric Ireland Munster Minor Football Championship 2, a pretty key game there to decide who goes forward to the Phase 1 final. Tipperary leading Limerick by 9-8. Tip just needing a draw tonight to progress. We'll be back with Wednesday Night Rugby after this.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
And you're very welcome along to Wednesday night's football show. It's Richie McCormack here with you in the big chair. Dan McDonald from the Irish Independent joins me in studio as well for what could well be a pivotal night in the Premier League title race. We have 4 minutes played in the second half at Old Trafford, and the score is Manchester United 0, Manchester City 0. Dan, you have taken in more of this one than I over the course of the last 45 minutes. What have people missed if they missed the first half?
I suppose it's been... absorbing is sometimes a word that's used for a nil-all game that hasn't had loads of chances in it. But just because the stakes are so high, there's just natural, there's a tension around it. But Manchester United started the game pretty well. You know, they were probably maybe the better side early on and had a degree of pressure without necessarily having outstanding opportunities. 20 minutes before half-time, City well on top. And it's funny, like we talked with Miguel beforehand about even concerns about Manchester United's fitness and so on, that they were actually just dropping off a bit as the half went on. They were actually...
There seemed to be a lot of space in midfield for City to operate.
They were almost like a team that's just been under pressure, and they were naturally falling back, retreating a small bit just because the body wasn't up to it, you know. And Sterling had the best chance. He did very well to sort of wriggle into space just before half time and just couldn't quite get enough power in the shot, and it's sort of, this thing was taken out of it. But we're watching Fernandinho go off here. But it was just, you know, it was pretty scrappy early on. Like, City definitely looked a bit jittery, a bit nervy, just gave the ball away at times, simple passes out of defence, just making mistakes that players of that calibre shouldn't really make. And United were just sort of industrious, and Ashley Young sort of, you know, defending sturdily. But I see Sané coming on now.
Looking to put the boot down here, City. When you're taking off Fernandinho, who is looking like he's after shipping a knock there, Leroy Sané's after coming on instead, just 5 minutes into the second half. There seems to be an impetus from Guardiola that they need to go for it.
They need a bit of an injection of pace or energy. They've been very nice and they've had the ball, but they've just lacked that real...
Cutting edge.
Now, I mean... they didn't necessarily get into positions in the first half where they were countering, you know, with any great sort of regularity.
The better chances were United's by my viewing of it anyway.
Yeah, no, they had their moments early on, and Rashford was certainly dangerous, and I mean, Pogba's had half a chance there. I mean, Roy Keane was making the point in the halftime analysis that Rashford was outstanding, and if they could get him one-on-one with company, they'd have a chance. And certainly, as City commit, you can sort of see a scenario where chances fall to Manchester United on the break.
But what about the title implications of this as well? Because obviously, with this, City, contrary to my poor maths earlier on, will remain second and will be a point adrift of Liverpool, and Liverpool will have the title race in their own hands from here on in. But for the stakes for Manchester United, considering what's going on at Molineux, with Wolves leading by 3-0 and deep in the second half they are there now too. Ruben Neves, Matt Doherty and Diogo Jota with the goals there. I mean, there presents itself a chance for Manchester United to really go into the top four and solidify the position there.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I mean, that's what ultimately people are going to be judged on, I guess, come the end of the year. So I know there's a fan subplot and stuff, but there is an opportunity there. And it's strange, we did speak before, you know, you talk about form and all logic suggests that one team should win, but there's definitely a sense that the occasion is really hanging over this game. And
from a neutral's point of view, like, the sense that Manchester United fans might want to not throw this game, but, you know, they'd be okay with a loss because ultimately it would cost Liverpool in the title race. I mean, it's lunacy when you consider what would be at stake if Manchester United miss out on Champions League football this season.
They don't have that Europa League parachute that they have.
There's a chance here. Sané's just squared the ball trying to get it through to Aguero in the 6-yard box, but cut out by the United defence. But the first real moment of threat since Sané's come on there.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, this is the league to some degree, as much as City still have a bit of work to do to get it done. But I just get a sense that I mean, we have 11 Manchester United players just in their own half at the moment, and I think that is going to be the theme pattern of the second half here, definitely. And yeah, Sané just gives them another option, and they have to mix it up a bit.
That's got to be the frustrating thing if you're a United fan, like to think that with 4-3 games to go towards the end of the season, this is where they are. They're trying to, and it's a goal, and a good goal,
Manchester
and a fantastic
City
goal, and it's a Manchester City goal. Bernardo Silva wheeling away on his knees. pumping the fists. He wriggled and wormed and tried to find some space towards the side of the Manchester United box, the right-hand side of the Manchester United box, and squirmed the shot under the grasp of David De Gea there.
I think it's even just even Sané coming on, it's given them a bit more to think about there. And Silva's on the right-hand side. And yeah, I mean, he cuts inside. Looks like he nutmegged the Manchester United defender and almost cut out De Gea at his near post by taking a clever angle. But, well, there we go now.
Well, that was the worrying pattern that I was saying the Manchester United were slipping into, because we're, what, 8 minutes into the second half. It was Gundogan who picks up the ball in midfield. He sprayed it out wide to Bernardo, who ran at Luke Shaw, managed to ping the ball through his legs and under the grasp of David De Gea, and City have a 1-0 lead. But as you mentioned, United were sitting back, had 10 men inside their own half, it became 11, and they were looking to do that for the next 40 minutes.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not a sustainable plan.
They didn't, to be honest, they didn't have to work too hard for that goal, City.
No.
You know, I mean, they kept the ball. It was they worked the pass into a one-on-one situation. It's a good strike. De Gea's actually maybe caught a bit unawares. I mean,
I think he's probably imagining Luke Shaw will do better in that position.
Yeah, it was just sloppy. There. It was actually the nature of the game. It's a pretty disappointing goal to concede.
Absolutely.
But that really now, I don't know. I suppose City have a lot of attacking players on the pitch, and what do? Do they just drive on and try and drive this home?
I would imagine they will.
I think that's what you probably have to do, because I don't think they have the skills maybe to go the other way, and I think that would invite trouble. So they have to probably just go on and close it out for
me. I think they would have looked at what's been in front of them for the past 2-3 minutes and decided that this is the side they can actually go and, if they put their minds to it, pick apart. They've got the four players to go and do it now. They've got United on the back foot in terms of morale, especially after going a goal ahead. And 55 minutes on the clock at Old Trafford. Manchester City 1, Manchester United now. There could well be 2 here. They're pinging the ball amongst each other. Sergio Aguero shoots and it's just wide to the left and wide of David De Gea's upright as he reached for that one. This could well turn out to be that 5-0 that Miguel predicted before the start of the game. It could well be 5-0 as well at Molineux. Still 3 goals between the sides. Wolves 3, Arsenal 0 is the score there. If you want to get in contact throughout the show tonight as well, you can text us 53106, tweet us at Off The Ball. A pretty big event coming up here in Ireland over the course of the next few weeks. From next week, from next Friday indeed, Ireland stages the Under-17 European Championships, with the hosts facing Greece, the Czech Republic and Belgium in Group A, and it comes off the back of 2 quarter-final appearances for Ireland in the last 2 editions of the tournament. Colin O'Brien, the man who masterminded both of those runs and hopes to go even further this time around, joined me in studio earlier on this afternoon. And with just a week to go until Ireland opened their campaign, I started by asking him how preparations have gone heading into the tournament.
Yeah, I suppose firstly our first game is Friday week, May 3rd, against Greece in Tala. Yeah, look, very excited. I suppose it's been building up for a while. This group of players, since under-15, knew they were going to be hosting the final as the host nation. So we took the group over in July. So we've been working with them for the last 10 months, July 2018, and we've been building up to this since then. So really looking forward to it.
How much face time do you get? Because I know we obviously... Ireland had to not go through the qualifiers as would normally be the case. We obviously had host duties, so we don't get the same level of preparation, especially on the pitch, that we would have done previously. How do you manage to work with the time that you do have with the players and have had with players over the course of the last year?
Yeah, it's been our objective has been a little bit different this season, but we'd still have more or less the same contact time with them from the start of the season right up to the tournament. It's just the difference is we just didn't have the qualifying games this year as such. But we made up for it. We looked at some very strong nations this year, some very testing games for the players to put them into that environment. And what's interesting is 2 of the teams in our groups, the Czech and Belgium, we've already encountered this season.
And what did you learn from both of those encounters? Not necessarily just from the opposition, but also from your own squad.
Well, you're always learning with your squad because, you know, it's not just about the game. It's, you know, when you come into international football, it's 24/7. The players are with you for morning, noon and night, basically, for whether it's a week and a half, or for the international, your under-17 tournament, it's going to be nearly 2 weeks they'll definitely be in for. So you learn a lot about them on the pitch and off the pitch, that whole dynamic. Get opportunity to work with them with how we work, with, you know, regarding training, meetings, how we want to play. And you find out a lot about the personalities and characters the team as well. So we've been looking at all those aspects since last July, and now we'll just be ready. The players will report in next Monday, and we'll be ready to go for the 3rd.
One of the things you said previously around the get-togethers that you had, especially around those friendlies with Finland, is that you wanted to mirror as much and as best as you can the situations surrounding tournament football. Having these games within 3 days of one another, essentially 3 days game, 3 days game,
it's a very unique situation for these group of players to try and play in that type of environment, to try and play when you're all that close together for that prolonged length of time. It is a difficult thing to try and mirror. How did you go about doing that?
Well, the process at international football was started under 15, so Jason Donoghue would have had this group, so they would have began that process, so some of them will be used to that. And then they move on to 16s with Paul Ozam, and so they've been used to that type of environment as well. And when they come in as 17s, basically the time might be a little bit longer when they come in, for there might be extra days and the games become more competitive for them, so we add that education to them for the players. So this year, we started with a training camp. We started with a home-based assessment in July, and then we went into a three-day training camp in August. Played our first double-headers against Turkey in September, and then in November, because that time of the year all the other countries are playing their first qualifying phase. So UEFA would have helped us with the funding for a three-team tournament in Dublin, in Tala, stay in the City West Hotel, train where we're looking to train. So last September and November, point being, is we played five matches. We played them in Ireland, so we were able to mirror where we were playing next week, basically, for the tournament. Come February then, we would have brought the squad away to Spain, which is good. You get a little bit more extra prep with them. Played Belgium and Poland out there. And March was always the tricky one for us this year, because that month is the elite phase for under-17s and 19s. So Finland, they didn't get through to the elite phase, which they were very unlucky. They lost to both France and Poland in the first qualifying phase. But they were a decent side. So again, that was a good test for us. Again, we played two games. So basically, since the players have been in, that was in Ireland as well. So, you know, of our, we'll say, four events, three of them we've used our advantage by playing at home.
You've got a squad that's, to look through, the most recent one, obviously, a name for those friendlies of Finland, was hewn from everywhere, from Balnamallard to Real Betis. I mean, as an under-17s head coach, how do you go about picking the best players and coalescing that squad as one? Because it is quite scattergun the way they are, just the nature of underage football, the way they're playing and where they're playing the club football at the moment.
Yeah, well, again, you'd have to go back to, you know, before even 15s, with the schoolboy set up. Now you have the National League set up coming to play, the emerging talent. So all those players, especially the homegrown and home-based players, would have been playing here, except the players that moved last July that are gone to the UK there in their first season. We'd have a broad network with regards to recruitment, especially in our own country here, both north, east, so west in the country. We've people watching games every week. I see a lot of matches myself, and also have a lot of people watching games, so you get reports on players every weekend, and then you get an opportunity to see these players. Then we'd have a process, maybe we'd bring players in earlier in the season to see where they're at, but as I said, a lot of that work would be done at 15s, 17s, but you always have to monitor young players. You know, there can be serious jumps in their development within 3 months, 6 months, so you have to keep an eye on them. So there's a few players might make our squad for the finals, have been in and around about it, and they'll still come back into the pitchers for 18 and 19s as well.
It seems now more than ever there seems to be a lot of more joined up thinking as regards the underage setups, and how, just in a linear term, how the under-15s graduate to the 17s and then beyond to Tom Owens, 19s, and hopefully, touch wood, 21s and seniors. It seems the elements and the systems put in place by Ruud Dokter, maybe even beforehand as well, seem to be actually bearing fruit this time around.
Yeah, well, there was some systems in place before Ruud joined us, and then Ruud has had a lot of stability to it, and it's great for us to have someone, you know, in Abbottstown with a football thinking as well, that we can go to, you know, with our issues or with our problems, and basically, you know, we work together as a team. You know, there's no one gone off on their own solo event. 15s, 19s, 17s, 18s, 21s. Mick has been involved with us since he's come in as well. So there is a lot of joined up thinking. We share ideas, insights, give a lot of feedback on how a lot of our games, our developments have gone with each squad. Working with a lot of talented people, very skilled and very passionate about Irish football.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere as well, there's outside coaches come in and you offer them to come in and analyse the games on your behalf and see what they can learn from them. That obviously is probably going to be a two-way street in terms of coaching. They're going to learn a lot and you're obviously going to pick up an extra pair of eyes on the squad as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's the 15s or 16s, especially if the teams are playing at home, you know, a lot of the international managers will go to those games as well. And so we just have very good communication between each other, and that's really important.
And what did Mick think of the setup when he came involved?
I think he was very impressed. I think, since he was in involved to where he was known, what he saw. Yeah, I think he was very impressed. And he also gave us a presentation recently regarding the senior team, which is really important for the whole line, as you said.
Yeah, it's going to be a massive boon. Looking at the tournament itself, you mentioned that we have prior knowledge of a couple of teams from recency in terms of the games. But setting into that first game of Greece, Friday week, I mean, you mentioned before how opening games of tournaments and opening games for the hosts in particular can go one of two ways. It can be really open and expansive, and you can see, like, the one that always brings to mind when I think of open and expansive is that Germany-Costa Rica game in 2006, which was like 4-2, which is mental. And then you have another one that's 0-0 and stodgy, and everyone's nervous, nobody wants to put a foot wrong. How best do you kind of coach, especially mentally, the players heading into that first game on Friday week?
Yeah, well, we've been prepping them throughout the season for that. Obviously, the prep will go up a little bit more once they're all in next Monday. Now we'll start our first pitch session on the Tuesday, and it'll be very much building to that first game. So you have that kind of balance of, yes, the opposition, the players nowadays, they want to know a lot about them, but also you have to focus on yourself. So you have to have that balance for the players. Look, you'll want them to go and express themselves. They'll still need to understand that there's a plan in the game, that there's a structure about how we're trying to go about the game as well. But sometimes there's just that unknown in that first game. The last couple of years, we did two very good performances in our opening game, but we lost the game. It's the three games are massive. Like, you have to plan for all three of them. You really want to be in the shake-up going into the last game. But right now, we just got to make sure we're prepared fully for the Greece game.
One of the things you're saying as well is that, when you head into these tournament situations, it's not necessarily all about winning medals, it's about the player development, and that's quite key, especially when you're at the age group that you've been looking after for the past couple of years. With that in mind, you obviously want to use your entire squad as best you can throughout these group stages as well. One of the main, I suppose, nice headaches you have heading into this tournament is you've got two rather good goalkeepers. You've got Jimmy Corcoran, who unfortunately is suspended given the events of 12 months ago for that Greek game, but a young lad called Gavin Bazunu has really put his head above the parapet in the last 12 months and has given you a nice selection headache there.
Yes, and what it also does mean, the fact that Jimmy is suspended for the first game because of the bizarre circumstances last year, his suspension doesn't kick into his first competitive game, which will be kicking in the tournament. With young Harry Halwex as well has come into the picture from Derby County, because we have to look at three goalkeepers, yeah, because you'll need two on the bench for that first game. So we've looked at that situation throughout the season. That's been another objective of us. How would it be fair if certain situations happened? So they've all had opportunity, which is good. They all understand what's required as the goalkeeper at international level. But yes, right now Gavin is once he's fit, gets through this weekend, he'll be available to play in the first game. It's important you go in with a good goalkeeper into the tournament.
When are you naming your final squad itself?
Monday.
Monday. There's been a lot of, judging by your reaction there, a lot of hair pulling out over the course of the last while. The anticipation of making phone calls to disappointed people, etc., is not the nicest of scenarios.
Throughout the whole year, we'd have a process with the players when they come in. We'd be very clear with feedback. The way analysis is now, players are, they learn a lot by visual. We say aids, but you have that feedback. We're very honest with them, but also players that might make a squad, as I said earlier, it's not that they're out of the picture, they just mightn't be ready right now. And I've seen that with a couple of players down the line, and now we see some of them progressing with the under 19s, so they got to persevere, those players, but also we've cooperation, and we'd say communication more so with the clubs that those players are involved with, because they've got the contact with them, they've got the more day-to-day stuff, so we provide feedback to the club coaches as well, which is really important for that player's development.
When you mention them learning through visual aids, what kind of stuff does that take the form of?
Personally, I just see the game, like just the analysis, the match, the videos. There's different aids. You've got your tactic boards, we'll say. You've got magic moves. I think coaches will understand what I mean with that presentation.
What's magic moves?
Basically, it's just a PowerPoint presentation where you can set up two teams on it, and basically you can the magnets move for you as opposed to a tactic board. You
have slightly more height depth than our tactics board over here.
A little bit, yeah. And you need someone good with a bit of technology on the the laptop to get it moving for you as well. But the big thing for me, the players, they still look at the game when you have the video up for them, and whether it's their individual, whether it's something with them in a unit as the team, that's where they learn a lot. And then the practical side on the pitch, the doing side of it, that's really big for them. So they're the areas that they get a lot of education on.
When you name that squad, one of the players who I think still qualifies for the age group is Troy Parrott. A lot of people would be interested to see if Troy's going to be involved this time round. I don't know if you've spoken to him about it, if you've spoken to Spurs about it, about whether or not he can be involved this time round. I'm not looking for a spoiler necessarily, but is there a chance that he could still be available to you?
We still haven't had the exact decision on it.
Okay.
But yes, to answer your question, we have spoken to Spurs, but it's a little bit more complex. You will know on Monday.
Okay, we'll know on Monday. Nothing for many spoilers on that front. We have to touch on what happened 12 months ago as well, because I think a lot of people, when they may have last seen you on camera, was that post-match interview with Tony O'Donoghue, whereby you were probably the most composed human being in that stadium. Even our senior manager at the time might necessarily have had the same composure as you at the time. A lot of people would have taken a lot of heart from that, in the sense that this guy's looking after our under-17s, and that's kind of the attitude we want to see. Whereas even if something catastrophically weird goes wrong for the side, that the guy looking after everybody has it down, says, listen lads, this isn't the end of the world, this is merely another step in our growth and our progression and our human evolving as well. That moment for you as well must have been a rush of emotions while you're trying to, I suppose, sum up what had just gone before.
Yeah, look, I've been asked about it a lot, whether it's friends or, you know, presentations you do around coach education, or work in that area as well around the country.
But you can see why. I mean, it was most people will be ranting and raving. People in a senior position will be going mental, but you were a vision of calm, but in the right way.
Yeah, look, I just felt that. Look, it was a bizarre set of circumstances. I think that everyone would agree on that. But there was probably that moment before the post-match interview as well, where we had kind of maybe a 7-10 minute spell with the players, and it was just so emotional. It really, really was, you know. And just felt the players needed to be given a lot of credit. It was their fourth game in the tournament. People might have forgot that, or might be aware of that possibly as well. And they were excellent throughout the tournament, how they played, how they represented, how they actually, you know, performed throughout the season. They were really, really good, and the same with the squad that went before them the year earlier. That's just how I felt. There was all sorts of emotions going on, in a broader view, you know, there was a lot of encouragement I saw from those players, because I'd worked with them throughout the season.
And it kind of leaves you in an ideal position as well, given the fact that this tournament is at home, that you can kind of harness that good feeling from home and get people. Because let's face it, I don't think we've hosted the under-17s since, what, 94?
One of the earlier.
And just generally, like, the idea of an Irish player playing a tournament of international football on home soil, for whatever reason, given the size of the country, given the, you know, performances of the senior sides, etc., doesn't happen every year. Mightn't happen again in these guys' career. So it's something for them to treasure, but it's also something for the public to take hold of.
Yeah, I think you're hitting a lot there. To the public, I suppose, this is a massive event for the players. It's the biggest international event they can play in Europe for their age group, which is U17s. It's a big platform for them. If people are interested in research and looking at players that play, you know, going back many years, you know, from different countries, there's been some excellent players playing it and gone on to play, you know, at a high level within the game. So that platform's there for them. But to play at home is really, really special. We're going to embrace it, you know what I mean? We're not going to be putting the pressure on the players. We're really going to embrace it. We want them to really seize the opportunity, grasp it. And, you know, the support, you know, Irish support normally is really, really good at coming out and supporting their teams. And we'll be asking for that as well. We'll need that 12th, 13th man, because the three games in the 7 days is pretty demanding.
Yeah.
And the players, I know they'll really, really appreciate that that support. And hopefully the people will come out and watch us.
And it's set up nicely for people to do. Under-16s get in free. It's a fiver for adults. I mean, you can't ask for fairer than that, I guess.
I think so. And I think, you know, what I'm hoping to see is a lot of young faces there, because, you know, there's players playing the game, maybe 9, 10, 11, aspiring to be an Irish international player. They're going to see a high-level tournament of the best of the best in Europe on their doorstep. Come out and support us. Watch the teams, you know, come and support Ireland if you can, get to see other teams so you can see the profile of players, how other teams play, the level of the game, the demands of the game at that age group. So I think it's a great opportunity, even from an educational point of view, for young players and coaches that are working with the youth. You know, it encouraged them to go and see games.
And listen, after the last 6 weeks we've had, I guess it's a nice chance for a good Irish football story.
100%. Look, we're fully focused on this. Staff, I know, and all the players, they have to play their last. A lot of them are playing their last round of league matches this weekend. So, you know, hopefully they'll all come through that fine and get them in on Monday, and we'll be ready to go on the May 3rd.
Very good. We wish you all the very best, and all the best in the future endeavours as well. Further on, I know you've been 3 years in the job. Is there appetite to continue on beyond this point, or
look, just delighted to be contributing to the international setup at the moment with the youth setup, and this group now is just taking up all the focus.
Yeah, I can see the smile on your face. You're actually relishing, looking forward to these next couple of weeks.
100%.
Yeah, brilliant. Colin O'Brien, thanks so much for taking time out to speak to us. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, really interesting guy, Colin O'Brien. And Ireland opened their campaign against Greece on Friday week at Talas Stadium. Manchester City 2, Manchester United 0. Dan, the score. And that introduction of Leroy Sané has really changed things.
Yeah, I was just a straightforward goal to some degree. I mean, City breaking through the middle at pace, and Sterling fed Sané on the left side. Powerful left foot shot. De Gea sort of went at it with his feet.
De Gea is going at it as if he thinks the ball is going to go across him to his left, but has to correct mid-save and ends up trying to save it with his foot,
and ends up
which looks poor.
Ricocheting in off him. So it was poor. Darmian pulled out of shape a bit. It was just poor on a number of levels, but
United don't even look close to getting going.
No,
they could shut my mouth straight away. With Rashford trying to find Lukaku, who has been brought on, he's trying to find himself some shape and some space in the box, but ultimately it goes out for
and Lingard had a chance at 1-0, we should say, just the ball sort of across the goal, he just couldn't quite get a connection on it, but yeah, otherwise very dominant City.
Arsenal pull one back at Molineux, though they are into injury time there. Wolves 3, Arsenal 1, Sokratis Papastathopoulos with the goal there. More, including an interview with James Collins coming up after this.
Football on Off The Ball, brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back. Manchester United 0, Manchester City 2, 13 and a half minutes to go at Old Trafford, and United over 500 minutes without a goal from open play, and that just keeps ticking along. And it is 3-1-2 Wolves into injury time at Molineux in tonight's other game. It's been a good day for Irish players. Dan Randolph named in the Championship Team of the Year. Aidan McGeady was in the League One Team of the Year, as was Luton Town striker James Collins. I spoke to him earlier this afternoon. 24 goals to his names for the Hatters this campaign, as they are on course for promotion to the Championship. Anna began by congratulating James on him being included today in that PFA League One Team of the Year.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
What does an honour like that mean to somebody like yourself?
Oh, yeah, it's a great honour. A couple of weeks ago, I managed to get named in the EFL Team of the Year, and then I got the news today that we've been named in the PFA Team of the Year. So to be recognised by your fellow professionals, it's a massive honour.
You're kind of having one of those seasons that for anybody, really, it's been hard to ignore. When you consider what 24 league goals, the most recent of which was in that draw at Wimbledon, it's been quite the season for you.
Yeah, it's been a surreal season, really, personally, and obviously collectively with the team. How we're doing in the league this year, and hopefully making that step up to the Championship. But for me personally, to be involved so much with goals and having a good season in front of goal, it couldn't have went any better for me personally, so I'm delighted.
And a lot of people may have kind of had their doubts about the promotion push of Luton, considering how far the club had come, especially in the last 2 years or so, and under the tutelage of Nathan Jones, who left for Stoke back in January with the club second in the table. Since then, Mick Harford installed as temporary boss. A lot of people may have wrongly presumed that that would be the end of Luton's promotion push, that Nathan Jones was the be-all and end-all of everything that had been good behind that club. But it shows that there had been a pretty strong team ethic and a strong base in terms of tactics had been formulated there, that you know, you could kick on from Nathan departing for Stoke and continue that push for promotion, which is nearly, I mean, these are nearly over the line in those terms.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people did think once Nathan Jones did leave for Stoke that the wheels might fall off, and we might have got a bit disheartened and maybe slipped off a little bit. But it's been the complete opposite, really. We had a fantastic start to the season with Nathan, and he left us when we were top of the league, and it was quite close. And then we went on an unbelievable run of 28 games unbeaten, and And Mick Arthur's got to take some big credit for that, because he hasn't changed a hell of a lot. He's kept the same system. He's kept the same training regimes. He's kept the same personnel in the team, whether unless there's been suspensions or injuries. But the majority of the team has been the same. And he's just been given us the confidence to go out and perform and show people what we can do. And I think that's led us to where we are now. And we can even after last night's result, we're still in a good position, and we can sort of smell that championship at the minute. But we know we've got two big games to go, and I think the lads are really up for it.
Yeah, in terms of what Mick has done since he came in, you said he's very little has changed since his appointment. What was his first kind of message in the dressing room when he was appointed back in January?
His message, it was clear that he was just taking over part-time. He made it clear to us that he didn't want the job because he's very good at his job upstairs, head of recruitment, and because he had a big hand in bringing a lot of the players in our squad with Nathan Jones. So he knows us all personally as well. So he made it clear that he was just taking over and he was overlooking things. But he's a Luton hero, and the fans love him, the lads love him, and we all wanted to do well for him and the staff. And he instilled confidence into us, and he gave us the freedom to go out and play. And he said that he's not going to change a hell of a lot. He's just going to keep the train going. And to be fair to him, he's done just that.
Because there seems to be a lot of momentum behind Luton Town at the moment. Not only, obviously, has been the sale up through the leagues in the past couple of years, there's also talk of a new ground coming, Kenilworth Road. I suppose for a number of years has kind of been living, I suppose, a charmed life in terms of the facilities and the availability and the ease of getting to that ground. There's talk of a new home. There's talk, obviously, you're probably, touch wood, going to be up in the Championship next term. There must be a real sense of buoyancy and just a joie de vivre about the club at the moment.
Yeah, there is. It's definitely a club on the up. From the moment I walked through the door 2 years ago, there was plans for this ground to be done. They've got planning for that this year now, so I think that's going to be ready in 2021. We just recently moved into a new training ground, which is championship quality facilities, which is always good. And we've got that fan base behind us as well. Our fans have sold out every home game this year, and they've backed us their full allocation away from home. And if we can get to the championship and reward them and say thank you for following us like that, then it's definitely going to be a club on the up for when it does move into its new stadium.
Absolutely, and the championship will be a completely fresh challenge as well for the club too. Just talking about yourself, because obviously you would have been through the clubs yourself en route to Luton Town, the likes of Hibs. You would have played under Pat Fellin, the ex-Bohemians and Shamrock Rovers boss. He would have played under Terry Butcher there as well. And under one Paolo Di Canio as well at Swindon Town, who I know was very fond of you when you joined him there too.
Yeah, I played with some great managers, Di Canio being one of them. I really enjoyed working with Di Canio. He was the reason why I signed for Swindon. I went and met him, and I loved everything about him, his enthusiasm for the game, his attention to detail, his work ethic, and he said to me he'd make me a better player, and I thoroughly believe in the 6 months I was with him that he did. And I was gutted when he left in the January, because he's another one that left us when we were top of the league. We were Swindon in League One, and we ended up finishing in sixth place and losing in the playoffs. So when it happened this year with Nathan Jones, he left pretty much a similar time with us top of the league. I sort of had my doubts whether we would kick on or whether it'd go the same way as it did at Swindon, but we've managed to do the complete opposite this year and just kept that good run going.
Has there been talk about who's going to eventually replace Nathan full-time at Kenilworth Road there from next season yet, or are you going to wait till those games with Burton and Oxford are out of the way?
I think Mick has got the job until the end of the season, so yeah. I think once the end of the season's finished, I think we'll know a little bit more. We haven't been told too much, if I'm honest. So I think once we know where we are next year, I think then I think the board will start looking to appoint a permanent manager.
Very good. As you mentioned, in terms of your own form, it got you selected in that EFL Team of the Year and today as well in the PFA Team of the Year. It meant your form couldn't be ignored. That too is transferred to the international fold. You've been involved in the last couple of Republic of Ireland squads. Mick McCarthy obviously has been to watch you a couple of times What was that meant to you to be called up? I know there's a Mullingar background to your family.
Yeah, it was an absolute honour. When I found out that the Ireland staff were coming to the games, I just tried doing the best I could, and I tried to just not changing too much and sticking to my game. And I think every time they came to watch me, I managed to score, which was obviously a positive for me. But once I got that call up, once I got on that preliminary squad, they didn't want to get my hopes up too much because I didn't know if I'd make the final cut. But once I made that final cut and got in the squad for the qualifiers, there was not a happier man on the planet than me, because I'd started from the bottom, I've worked my way up, and to be recognised by your country and get that call up for the first time, it's such an honour. And it was a fantastic experience being away with the squad, seeing how them high quality players train and look after themselves and go about their business day by day. It was such a good experience, and I loved every minute of it.
I want to know, how Irish was the household growing up? I believe, is it your mum's side is the West Meath?
Yeah, my mum's from Mullingar. So
lots of Joe Dolan in the house as a kid, was it?
Pardon?
Lots of Joe Dolan tapes and CDs in the house as a kid?
Yeah. So she's my connection, and she was a proud mum when it happened as well.
Yeah, and just being in around, like, what kind of a manager is Mick to be in to work under, and the setup there with Terry and with Robbie as well?
Oh, it was fantastic setup. I think I was going into a new camp, but all the lads that have been in the squads previously, it was a fresh start for them too, because it was the first camp they'd ever been in with the new manager and the new staff. So it was all sort of everyone was having a fresh start, and the manager had new ideas. He had a great work ethic. Training was to a high standard. It was tough. It was good intensity. And then you've got obviously people like Robbie Keane, who's got the utmost respect from everyone in the squad, and that quality, and just learning from him day to day was surreal, and I really enjoyed it.
We've suddenly found ourselves in a, you know, from a period where obviously we found goals hard to come by on the international stage. There seems to be a lot of forwards, particularly in the Football League, performing really, really well. When you think of how Callum Robinson has come back from his injury at Preston, we've seen David McGoldrick and the work he's done at Sheffield United, a kind of a last-minute signing there this season, but is really, really impressed. And then yourself at Luton, add into that, you know, Shane Long suddenly started scoring goals again. Michael Obafemi at some stage will come back from injury. It's a really, really healthy mix of strikers we've got at the moment. What can you do to stand out, do you think, to Mick and to the others over the course of the next year or 18 months?
Well, you've just mentioned some fantastic strikers there, and they're all playing at a great level, and they're all doing really, really well. And I think for me, all I can do is just keep scoring goals, and hopefully get Luton into the Championship. And then if I am playing in the Championship next year, then it gives me a chance to have a crack at a higher level. And if I can manage to succeed at that level, then I think that will give me a better chance of staying in and around the Ireland squads, because all the people that you mentioned there all do play in the Championship or higher. And I think that always is an advantage when you do that. So all I can do is concentrate on Luton Town and keep my performances to a high level and keep hunting in the back of the net. And then what will be, will be.
You seem to have, from somebody who's obviously been around a few clubs now at this stage, you seem fairly at home at Luton. That's the sense I get from you at the minute.
Yeah, I am. It's such a family club, and I'm really happy there. I've got some good friends there. My family are happy here, and it's a place where I want to play my football, and I've got a couple of years left after this one, so I've got my security there as well. So at the minute, I'm really happy, and I'm really enjoying my football, and it's always nice to score goals and enjoy your football for any club, but to do it for Luton Town, it's a big privilege.
Well, jumping ahead, with fingers crossed that these two next games from Luton's point of view and for yourselves do go well, and you do get automatic promotion, and who knows, maybe even that League One title as well, what will Luton have to do to compete in the Championship next term, do you think?
I think we've got players in the squad that will be able to handle the Championship. Of course, the new manager will come in and have fresh ideas. He'll obviously want to bring in his new players. He'll obviously want to bring in some Championship experience, which I think you do need. So I'd say, apart from all that, I think he has got players at the club that could handle it. And he's got a lot of players at the club that have never played in the Championship either. So it's a fresh challenge for them. And me, I'd back any of my teammates to make that step up, definitely.
Well, James, it's been a remarkable thing to look at your form this season from afar and see those 20-odd goals you've bashed in so far for Luton, and who knows, maybe in these last two games as well, there might be a couple more still to come. Congratulations.
Yeah,
congratulations on your sundry awards. Your mantelpiece is going to be groaning under the weight of them over the course of the next few weeks, so well done there.
Thank you very much, mate. It was a pleasure.
James, thanks so much for joining us.
Top man. See you soon.
Well
done. Bye.
There you go, that is James Collins, the Luton Town striker. Quite the season he's had. Manchester City are heading back to the top of the Premier League. Dan, they lead by 2-0. Stoppage time awaits at Old Trafford, and United really haven't laid a glove on City.
Nah, no, it's game over. It's junk time here.
Yeah, absolutely. City just have to see this one out from here on in. Possibly it's been pointed out by a number of people, the game in microcosm, 5'7", Raheem Sterling beating 6'3", Paul Pogba to an aerial challenge. That's how it's been for United tonight. Not a good night either for Arsenal fans. They've been beaten away to Wolves. Let's hear the full-time report on this one from Clive Edwards.
Full-time at Molineux, it's Wolves 3, Arsenal 1. Socrates got a late goal in the 79th minute for Arsenal, but it wasn't enough. Wolves scored 3 goals in the first half from Neves, Doherty and Jota, and Arsenal never really recovered from that. They had plenty of possession, did the Gunners, but they just lacked quality up front and were too careless in midfield. It's finished Wolves 3, Arsenal 1.
Spotter's badge to Dan McDonald, the Tears for Fears fan who spotted Everybody Wants to Rule the World in the background.
They played that twice before kickoff on Tala last night and the hour before the game. Heard on several occasions.
Getting ahead of themselves.
I don't know.
Fat lot of use it did them there. We'll pick through the bones of this Manchester derby after this.
Football on Off the Ball. Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
A minute of injury time remains at Old Trafford. It's Manchester United 0, Manchester City 2. And a lot of sides have been made look very average by Manchester City this season, Dan. The problem is for Manchester United, they've got the players to suggest on paper, and we talk about Manchester United on paper an awful lot, that they should be closer than they have been over the course of these 93 minutes plus.
Yeah, I know that, to be fair, they did name, I suppose, would you call it experimental side, or certainly there were some players involved, and we haven't been involved in some time. So maybe on paper in terms of tonight, but I suppose just as the club overall, with the talent that they have, they shouldn't be in a situation where they're losing 2-0 at home. The ground is emptied out in the last couple of minutes, and it's like a team that's not. It's like one of these games we were speaking about off air, where a team that's lower down the Premier League just gets beaten by the higher level force, and it's like, well, there you go. You know what you expect.
It's going to leave them 3 points off the Champions League places at this moment in time, and they don't look like, A, they deserve Champions League football based on the displays in recent weeks, and you could say before Solskjaer's arrival as well. And especially in these last couple of games, they just look so flat, so poor, and just bereft of ideas.
Yeah, and I don't know how they necessarily lift it. I know that obviously Arsenal have thrown it in again tonight, and that's given them sort of a bit of hope. And I mean, Chelsea, very, very uninspiring at the moment too. So maybe they can fall across the line. But given the belief that there's going to be there's upheaval coming in the summer anyway. They're heading back into what's now a sort of familiar state of crisis, really.
There's an entire new back four needed there. I don't think that's beyond the realm of saying. Like, you need vast improvements from players like who are pretty well had pedigree before coming to the club that seemed to suggest they're decent players, the likes of Lindelof and Bailly. Like, you do have scope to improve them, but they've no fullbacks. Luke Shaw has shown how naive he is generally tonight.
There's no spine, like there's no real spine to the team. There's no real sort of personality as it goes full time. But it's like, what is the personality of this side? Like, what way do they play really? Like, can you describe them? You know, I know that. I mean, that was the thing in the revival. Well, there you go. It's Manchester United back playing attacking. You know,
swashbuckling football.
But often that was like good counter attacking. You know, and I think you need more than that.
Building from positions they shouldn't necessarily find themselves in the first place.
Yeah, I think you need to. You look at the template that's been laid out by teams that can control games with real quality, and they don't really look to have those attributes. And I don't think it's just an easy fix here. You know, I don't know how you bridge the gap.
There's a lot of work needs doing there. It's not just one summer's work either.
No.
Hand held up by Paul Pogba, he looks almost apologetic as he heads off the pitch. There's been a steely glance and gaze from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer from the sideline with his arms folded for the last couple of minutes of that match as well. Pep Guardiola, obviously enough, a happy man despite the fact he's wearing that ratty cardigan slash coat.
His lucky coat.
It must be at this stage. They're back on top of the Premier League. They've got three games to go. They just need to win these three games and they're home and hosed as regarding winning back-to-back titles. The first of those games is this Sunday. It's away to Burnley. Then they've got the on May the 6th, the bank holiday Monday, they're at home to Leicester. And then the final day of the season, they are away to Brighton. The question is, where you see Manchester City dropping points from here on in?
I think if you're Liverpool, you probably want Brighton to be in relegation bother going to the last day of the season.
Yeah.
I think if Brighton manage to do enough to stay safe in the meantime, that one's gone. I mean, Leicester has ability on the side, and Burnley, let's give a cliche about it being a tough place to go.
Yeah. You know?
But they did get turned over by City in the Cup, didn't they, the last time they met?
But given what they've shown, particularly in the past two games, with that win over Spurs on Saturday, given that they had to overcome the mental, blow of going out of the Champions League to the same side and the exhaustion of having to play them again within 3-4 days, and now to come to Old Trafford and win without even having a glove laid on them.
Well, Liverpool will be Huddersfield on Friday, so they will still be in that catch-up scenario again on Sunday, and that still must be mentally draining. Like when you have that hanging over you in every match, and we'll see what the Fernandinho situation is, see what the De Bruyne situation is. They may not necessarily be able to start the game with the side they finished it with tonight, you know, for that particular type of challenge, but you might just be clutching at straws there to look for negatives when really they should do it. It's a bottle job if they don't do it now.
Now we're into bottle job territory.
I think if they don't do it now, it is. I mean, they have the ability to, like, in all normal circumstances, like, however many times out of 100 should they win the games that are coming up?
Yeah, no, it's a bottle job territory in the sense that, yeah, you're right. If they've beaten Spurs and Manchester United, which on paper, when everybody looked at the run-in, were like, oh, well, they're the two games where... Yeah,
it's not a bottle job if you drop points in those games, so I wouldn't ever subscribe to that. But yeah. I think if you drop points at Burnley on Sunday, you know, and that costs you the league, it'll be remembered for... The story of the season will be one game. It won't be anything else. Whereas from Liverpool's perspective, it won't be one game that defines their season if they lose out. It's just collective drop points at times, but really they didn't do a huge amount wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas if City throw it away from this position now, it'll be one game.
Dan,
it'll always be one game.
Thanks very much for coming in tonight.
Thanks
for spending tonight with us. Earlier on tonight's show, we asked you who is the leading the race to be crowned National Hunt Champion jockey. The answer, of course, is Paul Townend. And congratulations to Dennis Collins in Limerick, who wins a pair of tickets to the reserved enclosure, no less, at Punchestown Racecourse during next week's festival and goes into the overall draw on Saturday. That includes the hospitality lunch and bed and breakfast and an evening meal in the Louis Fitzgerald Hotel. Tomorrow morning at OTB AM is live on all your social channels from 7:45 AM. And we're back live tomorrow evening at 7. We'll play some of the highlights from tonight's Punchestown preview show that's happening down at the Alex Hotel. Ruby Walsh and Robbie Power among our guests. And John Giles will be with us too to look back on tonight's Manchester derby. The great Tom Dunn is up next. I've been Richie McCormack. Till next time, good night.
Football on Off the Ball. Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.